This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Barbenheimer special. With us is a Pop Culture Confidential favorite, Ryan McQuaid, executive editor over at Awards Watch, here to discuss and dissect. Ryan, I'm so happy that it's you that's here to talk to me about this.
I know. I've got my hat on, and I've got my, and it can be either a cowboy hat or it could be an Oppenheimer hat.
Pipe or a Barbie slide,
or mink. What do I got here? But no, I'm dressed to the nines, apparently, for these, for quite possibly the biggest film conversation we may ever have. Like, it feels like we've been building to this for quite some time.
Oh my God. Quickly talking about that, I mean, this whole thing, the double feature enthusiasm, do you think it will have an impact on box office?
You're looking at it already. Barbie and Oppenheimer are going to be, I think, truly case studies that we can talk about. I mean, there's some other films this year. It's been a really fascinating year for the box office, in my opinion, because this is like the what you could see for the future of cinema. And then it's in the middle of a writer's strike, in the middle of an actor's strike. But Barbie and Oppenheimer, they started with low expectations. You're talking about movies that, I think Barbie's opening projection was like 75 to 80, and Oppenheimer's was like 35 to 40. Now the projection is 160, yeah, for Barbie, and Oppenheimer is like 70.
Post-phenomenon.
So the idea of like, the idea that both of these films could pretty much essentially make back their budgets in the same weekend in which they open and have legs, because I've seen the Barbie screenings, at least in my area, and I've been talking back and forth with our Awards Watch colleagues, because they live in North Carolina and they live in New York and San Francisco and LA and all these, in Georgia, all these different places. So people want to go not just to their critic screens, they want to go see it in theaters. And getting a ticket is harder, I think, than getting a Taylor Swift ticket at this point. It is, because especially for Oppenheimer in 70 millimeter IMAX presentation right now, there are not, at least in my area, we are one of the 19 selected locations in America that have the 70 millimeter IMAX, the way that Christopher Nolan wants everyone to see it, the 11 miles of film, right?
Yeah.
For the next 2 weeks, there is not a single seat in the middle sections of those theaters. You have to see it either on the side or you have to see it in the first two rows. That says a lot about the word of mouth, building up the anticipation, and the power of these two filmmakers that we're talking about today. I really think that if it was anybody else other than Greta Gerwig or Christopher Nolan, I don't think that we would be having the same much anticipation either.
No, I completely agree. I think it's on the strength of these two, how much they're loved, expectations they have on every project that they do.
No, for sure.
So in what order did you see them? And was
I saw it, I think, in the correct order. I saw Barbie first. I did not see them back to back on the same day. I don't actually think that that's the right thing to do. I know that everybody is, there's the, what, the 200, 400,000 people on Fandango that are buying them as a back-to-back feature, mm-hmm, right? And I don't know if I want that much, because I think there's so much to both films, and it's not fair to those creatives to then, I think, it's going to be hard not to compare these two films, but I think for me, I would want to separate those two experiences because they are completely different than one another in all the best ways and some not great ways either. But I think that seeing it the way that I saw it, Barbie the first night, and then Oppenheimer the second night. I think that that was the best way to see it, in my opinion.
Both of these movies, even though they're so different and the genres are so different, they need some marinating.
Yeah.
I mean, you want some time to really sink in. How do I feel about this?
Like a meal in between. Like these are two meals within themselves. Yeah. I don't need like a 3-hour, you know, like napped and then go jump into the other one. You really need to process both of them. And I think that audiences aren't going to expect that because of the fact that I think that they think, and this is not to say anything negative or anything, they think Barbie is going to be this candy-coated fun time, which it is, but there's a lot more underneath the surface of that movie and on the surface of that too, that you're having just as much conversation about that film as you,
oh, yeah,
you will about Oppenheimer, though. But they're completely different conversations.
So I just want to warn, we will be spoiler heavy here. So if you're about to go see them or if you don't want to be spoiled, we're going to be talking freely here. Come back if once you've seen them or be prepared. I want to start with Christopher Nolan's epic Oppenheimer. Of course, everyone knows at this point, it's about the theoretical physicist who played an integral part in the Manhattan Project. For me, this is the culmination of Nolan's film universe, his obsessive characters, his time themes, science, morality, consequences of human actions, these type of things that he has done so much. And the package that he made here and how he brought all this together feels like the tip of the Nolan universe. Where for you did this fit into his universe?
I think you said it best. I mean, he's been building to this, much like Oppenheimer's building the bomb. He has been hinting at this at least for the last four films. You look at The Dark Knight Rises, there is a literal bomb in that movie. You look at Interstellar, that is about the desperacy of humanity and the search for scientific exploration and the power of that. And then you look at Dunkirk, obviously the easy comparison is World War II. That film is the inverse, though, of this, because that movie is really about what the average person can do to be a citizen within your country, what it means to be a patriot for your country, especially at the time of where the clock is ticking in that film, the three different time spheres. And this movie is the polar opposite of how a country can destroy a man and how your patriotism can then be used against you as a weapon. And it's not even that it's about patriotism. It's just about, I wrote in my review for Awards Watch, American exceptionalism, power dynamics, and how we haven't learned to stop doing that in our history even now. And then you look at Tenet's whole kind of idea about nuclear annihilation is at the core of that movie, and the reason why those characters are on a mission to stop a madman. And so you kind of add all that up and you put it in a pot, and then he has this wonderful book that he's using to adapt from, American Prometheus. It is the right time for him to make a movie like this. It's sometimes, though, you know, we see a director and we go, oh, the obvious choice. Oh, it's so obvious that he's going to make this movie. It's not really a surprise that he's going to make Oppenheimer. And sometimes the obvious choice is the correct choice because of the fact that, I mean, this is a masterpiece. I've been thinking about it since I've finished watching it, just like yourself. And I'm kind of in awe of how Nolan has taken his complaints of being a very cold director and turned that coldness into absolute cynicism and made a vital piece of cinema.
I think he's going in that direction.
He leans into the tendencies that he gets created.
And this was where it fits.
Well, it's also because, like, you know, J. Robert Oppenheimer isn't a cynic. You know, he's very much willing to create this. He's the cynicism comes from the creation of the bomb itself. And the more and more you start thinking about, you know, the fact that Nolan has said in multiple interviews that the reason why he was interested wasn't necessarily just about, you know, creating the big giant story of a man, was the idea that if they press that button, the atmosphere could explode and we could all die. And there was that possibility, and that the movie asks all the right questions at a time in which the country is at its most vulnerable. The world is at its most vulnerable. And weirdly enough, it is exactly the right kind of movie for him to tell right now. We are extremely vulnerable. We are at our worst now because of the events that happened here. We have not gotten any better. And we have not looked internally at why we are still technically in an arms race. We have never stopped being in an arms race. And he warned about this and no one's listened. And when you warn about stuff, especially back then with McCarthyism and the powers that be being as strong as they were, you could essentially take a hero and turn them into a villain. You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. It is using everything in his arsenal that he has created before to ultimately tell this story. And it is led by an absolutely magnificent performance from Cillian Murphy. Robert Downey Jr., I'm sure we will talk about him. Yes. Matt Damon, Emily Blunt, this entire cast, half of Hollywood's in this movie.
And two that I really want to mention, Benny Safdie and David Krumholtz. Benny Safdie, who plays Teller, quite a difficult role. And then his fellow Jewish-American physicist, Isidore Rabi, played by David Krumholtz, which both of those performances for me were just MVPs of the larger cast.
Yeah, I thought their performances were great. I thought Josh Hartnett's performance was, well, one, I'm just going to say it. Josh Hartnett is a snack and a half. And good Lord, when he showed up, even my wife was like, holy hell. Yeah, we were like transported back to the late 90s, 2000s when Josh Hartnett was dominating the scene. But no, I like his approach in the film too, because he plays Tellerman and their colleagues at Berkeley at the time. And the government trusts him because he is not leaning in like Robert is to leftist sort of radical ideas of the time, particularly members of the Communist Party. And through friendships, as well as his relationship with his brother, as well as his relationship with Jean, played by Florence Pugh in the film, he's drawn to multiple ideas. He's a theoretical physicist. So the idea of ideas, right, is what he gravitates towards. And so that can be dangerous in a lot of ways, because then that leaves you gullible and vulnerable when you're trying to get on a project like this. And so I love that scene between Murphy and Hartnett, where he basically is begging him to get onto this project because of what it means to him being a Jewish American man and a Jewish American physicist who is trying to stop the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And it's an understanding between the two that the radicalism has to end in order to be a revolutionary in a lot of ways. And I find that dichotomy to be fascinating. And then it leads into the conversation and the acceptance of between a really interesting dynamics between Cillian Murphy's character and Matt Damon's character in the film, which I thought were really interesting, between the military's ideas and then the scientific ideas that have been brought.
And Matt Damon so perfectly cast, because they very much so could not be more different in sensibility. These two, Oppenheimer and Matt Damon's character, who, and I have forgotten what his name.
Groves.
Groves, right. If we're talking about casting and or how he used characters, I wish there would have been more Florence Pugh, not just because she does it so well, but also because this is one of the most fascinating characters around Oppenheimer. Jean Tatlock was a brilliant psychiatrist, a political activist. She struggled with her sexuality. She was such an enigma, sort of mirroring the enigma of Oppenheimer himself. And I didn't find it quite enough to just say that she's brilliant. There would have been nothing missing there for me to have a little bit more of that character, that he could have fleshed that out a tad.
I agree. And it is the fault of the film. It is the fault, I think, of the American epic. I think of a lot of, when I was watching the film and I was thinking about it after, it reminds me of a movie that I do truly love, in Malcolm X. And I love Malcolm X. I think that is a masterpiece from Spike Lee, and another central performance talking about a figure that was completely misunderstood in its time and its own culture, destroying it within itself. In Denzel Washington playing Malcolm X in that film. But I always feel that the part that's underwritten in that film is his wife, played by Angela Bassett. And I agree. I think both female characters, though Blunt less more than Pugh.
He builds up to something. Yes,
he gives her an arc.
Yeah. She was apparently also very brilliant. And mm-hmm. there you basically get to see a very unhappy wife. But then you understand that what she sacrifices of her own integrity to save him, basically, in that last scene, you sort of get what you wanted with that character anyway. Once that comes, you feel more satisfied than I did with the Jean Tatlock character.
Yeah, Blunt's character feels, I mean, you could say she's the traditional housewife. I don't think that that's the case. I think that she's obviously a kind of a lost soul, and in a very, and everything, but she was brilliant. No, I mean, she was, but she was a very much a free spirit, but then also lost soul. But then you also see her caged in with the idea of being a domestic housewife, and the idea, you know, we see her, you know, because usually in these films you see her and she would be making a pie and the dinner would be on the table and everything. She's not that. She's completely miserable, and she's you can see, at least in the unspoken dialogue between the two of them, that there's a lot unsaid. They're not very happy, but they've lived through a lot of shit to get through this. And then when he's having to fight for his security clearance and basically his reputation at the end, she's the only one that is telling him, you need to get your head out of your ass and realize that you're being used right now. You're being destroyed. And she's the one that has to get him to fight. And then she has that amazing scene, I think, with Jason Clarke, who is also fantastic in this.
Yes.
But back to Florence Pugh real quick. I think that you're absolutely right. And it is the one character that's completely underwritten. It does not excuse this. I know that Nolan wrote this in a first person perspective, and that will be the excuse that a lot of people make, as to he wrote it in the first person, so this is Oppenheimer, you know, his through his mind and everything, and the two perspectives of the color versus the black and white and whatnot. That's fine and dandy if you want to say that. But this book that you have that you're adapting from, there are large sections of that book, from my understanding, that are completely locked into this relationship and how integral it was to him.
Yeah, you know? I mean, if she was a passionate love of his life, both, you know, passionate love as well as intellectual love, that's so passionate that he went back when she was in her terrible depressions.
And we see that in the film.
So yeah. I don't believe that even if it was in first person, he would have seen her. It is underwritten in that sense, because those are the things he would have seen.
She has like three scenes, and they feel like they're the shortest scenes of the film. It is a damn
just
waste.
For him.
Yeah, they're snapshots,
yeah.
You know, and it feels like, no, she's more than that. And then because then his reaction to when she, you know, when she passes, it is the kind of reaction you have when you have spent as an audience the time understanding that character and what they meant to Oppenheimer, and how deeply also, too, that scene feels and affects on Kitty as well. And what she says, we're like, we're not going to cry about your mistress or your mistakes here. We're going to get up and you're going to continue your work, which is a cold line of dialogue to say. And absolutely probably the truth in how she felt at the time. And it did linger a lot. And there was it's a very provocative and interesting shot that he uses in the film to display the affair in front of Kitty, which I thought was a bold an so interesting way of doing it. But
it's really on the nose, but in a terrific way. How you feel if your husband
horrifying.
Or your wife is having an affair and you're picturing it in your head. The passionate scenes are both very well done and very sort of because new to me for in the Nolan universe.
And I think that this isn't this is not just a Christopher Nolan problem. This is a problem of the genre. And I'm not excusing it. I did not excuse it in my review. Doesn't take away from the overall film and what it is saying and everything, but it is a problem that the genre has. And I was talking to Eric Anderson, our wonderful friend and my editor. I was saying, that's why I'm so glad that we're seeing a movie like Priscilla come out, because a movie from Sofia Coppola later this year, because I felt like in something like Elvis, a movie that everybody loved last year, the same damn thing happened there. So we're able to then tell their stories, and I want those stories told. And actually, I would prefer if it's told from a female perspective, because and I would love to see Kitty's story. I would love to see Jean's story and how tragic it is, and everything. But yeah, it is definitely the issue of the film. It is the probably glaring issue of the film for me. Other than that, there really isn't much more. But again, I think also too, it's not as an excuse like in his, he doesn't have really an excuse like he does in his original screenplays here, because he has a biography and these are real people he can adapt. I don't know if it was the IMAX cameras and also the 3-hour runtime, maybe there's a longer cut with more stuff. It feels like it, because why do you cast an actress like Florence Pugh for only these couple of scenes? So I would wish that there was more. I do want more, because I want to see more of those relationships, especially from these great actors that did have great chemistry together.
So I want to really get into Killian and to how Nolan has crafted Oppenheimer himself. But let's get in. I want to talk a little bit about how he narratively have put this. I think von Hoytema is doing some of his best work, also some of his best face work. I mean, what he does with these characters' faces, but I would like to really call out Jennifer Lane, the editor,
yes,
because this, for us to understand complicated narrative that Nolan's putting together, he's jumping between times and trials and psychological modes. And there's so many characters, so many political aspects. I think so much is her editing that we feel more than we usually do in Nolan's films in terms of emotionality. What do you think?
Yes, I absolutely agree. I think that she is an absolute MVP and vital. Again, to if I could use that that word is very much for this movie, because I think that. In particularly in the third act, when we go to Louis Strauss's point of view, mostly played by Robert Downey Jr. I think that there's a sequence, and we are in full spoiler, so I could talk about it, where Strauss has felt absolutely betrayed by Robert Oppenheimer. I mean, this is a man who has massive ego and integrity and power already. He's got the ear of the president. He's ahead of this commission. Of Atomic Energy, where Robert is also a board member and everything. And essentially, when they're talking about the H-bomb and they're talking about the future of using atomic weaponry in modern warfare, Oppenheimer starts becoming, like the rest of the scientific community behind the scenes, very, very nervous about it. And there's so many great lines of dialogue underneath. It's funny, everybody always gets on Nolan for one is dialogue, two is sound work. They're both perfect here, and you can hear it in this 70 millimeter or just regular IMAX form, however you saw it, and you can hear the lines of, well, we'll see about that, or we'll see how far you get with that, and these things that that Downey's character says back to Oppenheimer. And then of course this Oppenheimer's trial for his security clearance is going on at the same time as Strauss is being he's being confirmed for a position in, I think, what is it, Eisenhower's administration. And so, and of course, we all know in modern times, confirmation hearings can be very, very spicy. And Oppenheimer is the key front and center conversation about, you know, how, what did you do to this American hero, you know, and Admiral. And it's all from petty, you know, just conversations. And a lot of it's Robert's undoing, you know, of him embarrassing him at this hearing and all this different
the
stuff.
Swedish isotopes.
Exactly. And like talking about like it, like, you know, in a witty way, undermining Lewis in front of everybody in the community. And I love the edit because we see the edit of that scene through Strauss's perspective, and he's fine, cool, calm, and collected as he's kind of talking to Alden Ehrenreich's character. But when you see it through Oppenheimer's perspective, he's crushed. And you see Oppenheimer basically tell them, did to his, I think his co-counsel, was that good enough? You know, to kind of destroy him. And from that moment on, Downey just uses that superstar persona of his to kind of be this slow moving knife into Robert Oppenheimer's back. I just think of the way he's walking towards Einstein and Oppenheimer's conversation by the lake, how he's walking him to the car after Dane DeHaan serves him the papers for the inquiry. It's these slow little moves that you see, but they're just cuts. They're, you know, and every little thing. And then there's just this explosion of anger when the trial is not, the Senate hearing's not going his way. And it is incredible work by Robert Downey Jr. We have just not seen him do this for such a long time. And it's incredible work.
It's incredible. Talking about Jennifer and the editing, there's some terrific editing in that whole back and forth. What we're understanding about what he's going through is she brings that up.
Well, she's that's being edited and cross-cut with Strauss's anger is the interrogation by Jason Clarke and the explosion that Oppenheimer kind of has in his own hearing as well. And it's cut back and forth. And it is like a dance. It's tense. It's horrifying. I mean, like, I was at the edge of my seat more than I was at any point at Tenet. You know what I mean? Because it's just like you're getting thrown all this information and you're getting infuriated and your heart is breaking at the idea that, once again, these are people that we're supposed to trust, elected officials or people that are put in high positions of power here in the United States or just in any country, to be fair. And the idea of them having the power to play the game that manipulates someone that did such important work to save the world, to save lives, even though he destroyed lives.
Yes, I was going to say.
You know what I mean? It's the double-edged sword. And his burden already is having to live with the deaths in Japan. And I don't think a lot of people, when they know about this story, know about the fact that we didn't have to drop these bombs. We did this as like an exclamation mark went to the end of the war, when you really just needed to just, it was going to die out. And there was this whole idea of like, well, what if the Nazis get it, or somebody else gets it first? And this whole first thing, you know, like if you're first, you're last, kind of thing. And I think the decision making of the scene where they're talking about the decision to pick Japan is absolutely just American hypocrisy at its highest. When the secretary is like, well, we're not going to bomb that one place because I go to vacation there, so we can bomb the other two places. I sat there and I went, you got to be kidding me.
But this is a great segue. This is my question to you,
yeah,
Ryan.
All right.
The way that Nolan crafts Oppenheimer in the beginning is so fascinating. The fact that he feels like He's brilliant. He likes music and poetry, and the fact that he almost poisons his professor, you can see what kind of person he is in that, which gives you an idea of his morality. For me, Nolan does a better job in the first half of the movie of crafting the moral issues that Oppenheimer is dealing with than he does at the end. A couple weeks ago, I was listening to Kai Bird, the co-author of American Prometheus, and he was talking about the scene you were referencing, that he helped pick out the different cities where they would bomb. And he also met with the bombardiers to instruct them of the altitude. And he told them what city would be the best, where massive destruction would be. And I feel that a little bit that was taken away at the end, and it was more of a story of what happened between him and Strauss. And even though there's some very, very powerful, almost surrealistic scenes of his guilt, the fact that he didn't take those scenes that Kai Bird was talking about, there's something that I feel makes him more naive than he was. What do you think? Am I wrong?
Well, one, I would never say you're wrong.
I realized that it was a kangaroo court. The whole McCarthy-esque and was so unfair, but he never apologized for what he did, but he did try to course correct where the world was going in terms of an international nuclear arms race. There's something in the pit of my stomach. I would have wanted a little bit more moral complexity at the last hour as well.
I disagree. I think that it's all there. I think that the reason why he's not fighting, I think that the reason why he has to fight, he's sort of gobsmacked and sideswiped by Lewis and doesn't see it. And I think that it's because he's playing in a different sandbox at that point. He's not in control. And you know, some people are brilliant in their own fields, but when it comes to then having to be multi-brilliant in others, they are not as equipped to handle the political barrage that is American politics. And he's very much in command when he is creating this machine. And even when it goes, I think that from the moment that test goes off,
the Trinity,
he knows he knows exactly what he's done. He finally feels
he
the weight of
it.
I think that he's trying to save a lot of the, I mean, there's a lot of this in the film about the idea of communism and the idea of saving his name and the idea of the legacy that's going to, you know, of the men that are and women that are there, but also then too, you know, I said this in the review. I said, you would think that for a person is creating this weapon that he would be celebrating like everybody else, but he's not celebrating. He knows, and he's asked the question already, because then when they have that staff kind of meeting about like having a moral conundrum, and he says the line, which I think is a brilliant line, of like, they're not going to know what this thing is until we use it, and we have to use it. And
yeah, they're having a meeting where they're discussing what you were referencing before, that the war is basically over.
Yeah.
Now to bomb Japan basically starts the Cold War.
Yeah. And he's having to, you know, obviously by the scene in which they're picking that out, he's having to do it. He has to tell them all those bits of information, like you mentioned, because that is his job. And also because Groves and everybody know his file. They know that if he goes another way, he's going to be considered a communist and he's going to be locked up, essentially. So he has no choice at this point to do it right, and also to make sure that they understand then. But then the rest of the film is him fighting back to make, especially in those scenes, I think, in through Strauss's perspective in black and white, that then do cut back and forth to his perspective towards in the third act as well, too, of that the Atomic Energy Commission conversation, where they're talking about the future and how to use them. And he said from the beginning that this should be a UN coalition, that should not be just one world's dominance. And then, of course, it turns into an arm race. And that's kind of out of his hands at that point. And I think that what Nolan then does is, I think he purposefully and perfectly uses, you know, the scene in which you're talking about, the camera moving in to a close-up of Cillian Murphy's face when they see the devastation that caused in Japan, when he's understanding that, and it's told mostly that he's gone and said that they have to stop and that there needs to be, and a lot of it's in the beginning of the film that's about the events that happened, and exactly. You know, and that's kind of the cut back and forth between it as well. And he's not the one fighting for his reputation at the Strauss confirmation hearings either. It's somebody else that does that for him, because by that point, there's the brilliance of the ending when Einstein is talking to him about essentially that his life's work is going to be picked apart and scrutinized, and then a generation will go by and they will award him an award. And then there will be this banquet and food will be presented and all this different things. And you will sit there and see some of the people that destroyed your lives come and shake your hand. And
it's brilliant.
It's absolutely brilliant. And I think that for me, watching that third act, at least on the first viewing right now, I felt like him. The audience feels like him throughout the entire third act, where he is trying to explain his reasoning. He is trying to explain everything that happens post it. And he is getting picked apart left and right by this commission, this kangaroo court that you mentioned. He is not going to win this. And at a certain point, any fight that he has left in him is gone. His spirit, anything, it's just dissipated. They broke his soul. And by the end of it, I don't think I've seen a movie like that in a long time take its protagonist and break its soul in a 3-hour runtime. Like, it reminded me a lot, not comparing the two films and saying that they're the same in terms of quality, but it reminded me a lot what happens to T.S. Eliot in Lawrence of T.E. Lawrence and Lawrence
Salieri.
Of Arabia.
It's
a little bit of Mozart too, yeah. Right? That, like, you've drained him of all of his talent. And then, you know, and that's
and
why,
you have,
you know,
the ambition and the power that's basically killing you and everyone else to begin with. And then you have to live with both the consequences of your ambition and the consequences of what's being done to you. I just thought that the exploration of Oppenheimer's inner self was much more depicted in the first part of the movie than it was in the second one. Otherwise, I completely agree that that ending just brought it back.
Yeah.
Just talking about Cillian, the journey he takes emotionally with this character is just astounding.
I know that a good friend of mine and writer over at Awards Watch, Sophia Simonello, said, can't believe, you know, Cillian Murphy gave his Lydia Tarr performance this early in the year. Because it feels so like that movie, it feels like such an all encompassing role. And he's on the screen for such a large chunk of this movie. There's not, besides maybe some straw sequences there, he is in almost every frame, especially, you know, when they're at Los Alamos and you're following him, you know, as the, you know, through everything. I just think that he's worked great with Nolan for years in these bit parts and these. I think of his best role is actually in Dunkirk, where he's playing this conflicted soldier. And you see a lot of that, that emotion in that movie, because we've done rewatches of Nolan recently and Gerwig's films leading up to this. Like, you could see the pain and the scaredness of that character, and it's amplified up to 1,000. You know, there's stories of that he isolated himself from the rest of the cast because this is a behemoth of a role. And, you know, Nolan.
And I have to again say Hoyte van Hoytema, who, of course, is the master of IMAX and, you know, developing new lenses. But what he does with their faces in this one is really something else.
It conveys, I think, even more emotion or more language than the dialogue. Which is exquisite dialogue, but it's, but like, I think he might be the best cinematographer right now of his generation. And he's right up there, I think, with Deakins. When I get excited about somebody using the medium of visual language, but his work on like Nope, and everything last year, and even on Tenet, it's kind of built up to this moment with these IMAX cameras, and using this medium in a different way, because this is not an action movie. This is a drama. And I think that you're building to this moment. I think that maybe general audiences might get a little disappointed that, like, oh, the bomb test wasn't that, you know, but I think it's like,
oh, really?
A crown jewel. And like Nolan's, well, you know, people
I'm worried they'll say we didn't see Hiroshima.
Yeah, though I think that is absolutely the right choice not to do that.
Best choice ever. I'm just saying that the one that we do see is horrifying and beautiful and scariest thing I've seen.
I think that takes the point of what, you know, seeing, you know, in Japan. No, I agree with you, but I agree that, yeah, there could be like those complaints. But honestly, that's, again, not a story for Nolan to tell. Honestly, it's for other filmmakers to be able to tell that perspective.
Is it fair to say that both Nolan and Hoyte are really finding a way towards emotionality?
It's the intimacy that I think that this format, because it's so grand, then you're able to see all the emotions on those big giant faces up on that screen and realize that then that becomes, this movie becomes a horror movie in a lot of ways. And I think that that's, you know, from just like, I think the grand shots of their face equal, I think, the same amount of terror I had when I saw that blood dripped house in Nope. You're feeling this sense of terror, and you have to feel that in order to buy into the level of urgency that this story and this time period is. It's, you know, I know a lot of movies have been made about this era and about this subject, and there's been shows and movies made about it, but none of them have really ever gotten that urgency and that ticking time. I mean, Nolan is a master an obsession with time. And, you know, I noted it at the beginning of my review for Awards Watch. We've seen these promotional, billboards and all these different things with this clock ticking. And we all just assume it is leading towards the release date for this film, but it is releasing towards the actual anniversary, which is like 5 days before, which is July 15th, which is when the Trinity test was done 68 years ago. And I find that to be such a, well, one, that's such a Nolan choice to do, right? To get a studio to, yeah, we're going to have a countdown and no one's going to like actually know what it really
is. It's
going
to be wrong.
It's going to be wrong and everybody's going to love it. But of course it's this clock ticking. And then I think you bring in the sound and then Ludwig Göransson's score to build that tension. And like you're talking about with like the countdown in the film, but then it's the sounds, the whoosh, whoosh, you know, and everything from when he's in school and feeling the pressure of the math and everything coming together. But then when he finally does have it, and it's the lead up then to the Trinity test, it's incredible cinema. Anyone that doesn't think that this sequence is like one of the best of the year.
All of a sudden,
when it cuts my breath. Yeah. And you know what, and that's the brilliance of it, isn't it? Is that you know what's going to happen. It's like Titanic. You know the ship's going down, but it's the way it goes down. It's the way it's executed. It's brilliant.
You were mentioning Nope because both Bruce DeJean, the production designer, and Hoyte, who did Nope, and has the same as Los Alamos, this Western type, almost like a sect-like environment in Los Alamos, which is the reason this community was able to pull this off morally and ethically and have all their families live there sort of isolated.
Yeah, only a madman could come up with the idea of bring your families there because they'll work better and create a 2-year community, or like, what is it? Three years. And it was $2 billion, you know, or something like that. It was a very long process to create all this stuff. And I love when he's like introducing it to, I think, Matt Damon. He's like, there's a saloon. You know what I mean?
It's like a sect. It's an isolated community with their own morals, ethics, and reasons for doing this. And the connections to the outside world are what they decide.
Yeah, and somebody says he's the sheriff. I think it's Strauss that says he's the sheriff running, you know, Los Alamos. And you feel the Western vibes of it for sure. You know what I mean? And I know that Nolan has himself very much talked about that this is the closest he'll get to making some sort of a Western. And I think using Hoyta with that, because coming off of Nope, that's very much, there's a lot of Western tropes that are inside that film as well.
But Western tropes in this ominous way that he did both in Nope and in this one, they symbolize something else about America.
Yeah.
Then maybe Sergio Leone's picture of the West. I mean, it's something different.
Well, then there was the nights in and around Los Alamos too, that the night sequences when they're shooting it before it's built and after it's built, it was the photography reminded me a lot of the photography and something like There Will Be Blood, where it is these dark, beautiful landscapes being used as a backdrop for, you know, a moral conundrum about American exceptionalism and American capitalism and greed.
Killers of the Flower Moon coming.
Oh, we're going to be, we're spoiled.
We're exploring this side of America.
We're going to be very spoiled with cinema this year, folks. I don't know what to tell you.
So I want to move on to Barbie now, but is there anything, last reflections you want to do?
I can only say, please see it on the biggest screen possible. I can only say that I think that it is, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, Malcolm X, JFK, The Insider, these large three-hour Amadeus, all these three-hour epics that have something very vital and important to say. Very timely movie. And I hope that people go ahead and give it a shot. And I know that everybody gets scared at a 3-hour runtime. If you can watch a bunch of CGI superheroes beat the hell out of each other for 3 hours, you can see something that truly needs to be retaught or relearned in this country, because I don't think people know the full story of this. I think that this is his best work since The Dark Knight. It might be his second best film outside The Prestige. Time's going to be tough. I'm going to see this movie like at least 2 or 3 more times in theaters, because I think that, like Barbie, you're not going to get an experience like this for a while. Yeah.
And I think you have to see them both a couple times to catch things in the periphery that you know, I was just thinking about the shot with in the first interrogation where you see Kitty sitting behind. I was concentrating on her so much that I wasn't thinking about him. I mean, there's all these subtleties that they're doing there, which means so much later in the story.
I will say one last thing is that if this is what we get because Warner Brothers pisses him off and he goes to Universal and with the less money than he did the previous film before, and has like
piss
a chip on
more,
and have a
studios.
Chip on his shoulder, please piss him off more because like, because that's, then we all benefit from that great cinema.
All right, let's move on to Gerwig's Barbie, which she co-wrote with her partner, Noah Baumbach. For me, she pulled it off. She, after this massive PR explosion running up to this, she managed to really toe the commercial line that she had to do with this big movie financed by Mattel. At the same time, put a spotlight on the cultural implications and problems of Barbie, feminism, patriarchy. She brought in the history of the doll with the creator, Ruth. It's crazy. It's camp. It has its problems that we will get to. But in the big picture, for me, she pulled it off. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you felt the reactions of the critics were. To me, I felt there was more particularly men who were not liking this.
Well, I think it's the also the dark side of this Barbenheimer conversation. I mean, shoot, we jokingly talked about it when we did our summer movie draft. But it's something that I kind of, because we can't just have nice things anymore. We always have to make everything a goddamn competition. And it really just, and then it turns into a very sexist competition. Like only girls are going to like Barbie and only guys are going to like Oppenheimer. And that's bullshit because I know people that are both men, women, non-binary, gay, straight, you know, all different, you know, ethnicities that have liked
and
both films.
The Barbenheimer phenomenon has really shown, I mean, that the groups have come together and they're seeing each other's pictures.
The casts have come together. The filmmakers have mostly come together. You even got Tom Cruise saying he's going to go see the darn thing because
Tom Cruise wants
everyone to go see a film, but he won't go and stand out on a picket line or anything. But, you know, that's a different story for another time. But I think that, I think personally, I think that these critics, I mean, one, some of them, it is their own opinions. I think you have to say that if they didn't like the film on its own merit, I understand.
Oh, of course.
The conversation then needs to be, why is there so many damn male critics out there that are, one, covering this film if their female colleagues were not offered the opportunity to do so, or if there aren't any enough female writers on their staffs. I know that I wrote in the most, of course, sexist, I guess you could say, like, stereotypical faction. You know, I wrote the Oppenheimer review and Sophia Simonello wrote the Barbie review over at Awards Watch. But yet we talked through the process of writing both of those. We had conversations both on text and phone calls about those films to really hash out and make sure that those reviews reflected the films that we saw. And those are, they were wonderful conversations, but I don't think that people, I think when you have embargoes that are like, you got to quickly turn around everything. I think that in the instant reaction, Twitter, you know, thread,
studios are not,
you know,
helping with those quick.
It's not helping at all. And I think that, you know, I think that you can go into a movie if you don't like it or not, but it goes both ways. If you don't like it, don't have an agenda behind it. But if somebody also does say that they don't like this movie, don't go into their DMs or into their Twitter replies and attack them for saying something that they truly believe. Now, some people are just insufferable to begin with, and that we cover in this profession or are colleagues of ours at other sites, and you just know what kind of movies they're going to like and what they don't. But I personally was looking forward to both of these films. I'm a massive Greta Gerwig fan. I thought that Lady Bird was a masterpiece, and that Little Women made me cry when I saw it in theaters. And then I saw it, like, I think last week or 2 weeks ago at home, and I was crying even more than that go around. So she's a director that has like a pulse into my soul right now. And most people's too. I think that what's been great about Greta Gerwig's career of late is she's been able to pull in both male and female audiences together. She has a real universality around her. That's why when she's gone out in the press and said, I'm trying to make movies like my weekend buddy, Mr. Christopher Nolan, it makes total sense that her next big project is this wild, ambitious, candy-coated dreamscape that is Barbie. You know,
it's been a really interesting to see the reactions, and that they've mostly, the whole fandom, we hate that movie, we have to love that movie, then we have to hate that movie, and the, you know, vitriol. I haven't seen that as much. And the critics who have liked or disliked have done so with interesting perspectives on both movies, but particularly this one.
Yeah, I think also it's, and this is maybe unfair to both of the films, but I think that comedy is much more, I think, it's very much more subjective than drama. So, and it's very hard to make everyone laugh. I think you're able to kind of like make a dramatic story and everybody can watch that, but it really is hard to make everybody laugh at a joke. That's why I think some of the best actors are great comedians. because if you're able to make somebody laugh, you can make somebody
cry.
Yeah. And I think that that's.
Did you laugh, Barbie? Did you like?
I really liked it. I need to see it again because I think for most comedies nowadays, a lot of jokes fly by so quick, and this movie flies by so quick that I did feel like I missed some. Also, you know, I had to like drive 2 hours to see it, and it was a big production just to go see the film. I have to say though, the one thing that as it's lingered and I've thought about it in anticipation to see it again, it's so ambitious. It is such an ambitious film from a director that is given a blank check to create a movie based off an existing property, but not a film existing property. It reminds me a lot of like when Pirates of the Caribbean was created. How are you going to make a movie entertaining enough about a theme park ride? And then of course there's like the Lego movie. How are you going to make a movie about these little things, you know, these little toys work? And she does it with, you know, with flying colors. She's an incredible writer and director. You can tell early on the influences of this movie. Like, you know, I mean, Singing in the Rain and Jacques Demy, but then something even as crazy as, you know, Truman Show, Wizard of Oz, even like you could feel like Eric Anderson was saying, he was saying Austin Powers in a way, and the goofiness of those films. And I found it to be so much fun. What I wasn't expecting was this massive commentary on the patriarchy in this film that I thought, while very on the nose, was handled much better than a lot of men do when they try to talk about this stuff, because there's also a lot of sincerity throughout the rest of the storyline and throughout a lot of the rest of the character, and a lot of truth also mixed with within all these ideas are these dazzling dance numbers and choreography and music and these wonderful performances for Margot Robbie, who might have just delivered her best performance to date. And I was kind of shocked how existential her Barbie was going to be, because she plays quote unquote stereotypical Barbie, but she really becomes existential Barbie by the end of the film. I think Ryan Gosling, who I've always known to be a comedic genius because I've seen him on late night shows and whatnot, but also I've seen The Nice Guys, and he's incredible in that movie. So it was not surprising for me at all for him to be great here. I mean, you have like Issa Rae and American Ferreira and Michael Cera as Alan and Kate McKinnon. You know, there was a lot of great here. There are a couple of things that I think the film that struggles from it to being a 100% like great movie. I think that the pacing, because it's so ambitious and doing so many things, I don't think it's as tight as Little Women or Lady Bird, structurally.
Especially the last act.
Yeah, the last act. There's a lot going on. And I can get over that because of the ambition. And some of those sequences are just like, I'm not going to get rid of them because they're too good. I felt the second act was much stronger than the first act, but a lot of the first act is the materials that they've shown us. So I do also appreciate the fact that like we didn't see the end of this movie in any of the promotional materials. I do think, though, that the Will Ferrell stuff, which is like, I think 15 minutes of this movie could get completely cut out. It's not that I think the character is poorly written. It's that I think I would rather have seen a different actor play that character, because Will Ferrell, it just felt very graining. And it also feels like that stuff, that meta contextuality that's already there without those characters.
Yeah, because there's a few digs she does at Mattel, which is not the Will Ferrell part, which I thought were pretty strong, when the daughter, for example, tells Barbie, you ruined the lives.
You ruined feminism.
You ruined feminism for all girls. This is some of the lines in the boardroom was like, yes, we've had two women here in the board in sometime in 1980.
And I'm sure there was one before. I think the boardroom scene is great enough, but then when you have them start chasing after him and doing all that stuff, and it feels like if you take them out of the movie, you can kind of just wrap everything up, you know, neatly. And then, I don't know, American Ferreira could have just come back and told them what happened. And I think it would have just been fine. You know what I mean? That
an America Ferreira speech. Oh my God.
I need to watch it again so I can hear it all again, because it was talk about just moving the camera right into her perspective. I felt though like the connection between her and Barbie by the end could have been more solidified, because she does then seem like she becomes like everyone's connection when obviously the film starts off with them having this connection, because Ferreira and her daughter in the film are having this riff, and she's becoming sort of depressed. And then there's also, you know, that she wants to, it seems like, also create Barbies and things of that nature. So I felt like a little bit of her thread in the film was a little loose, and again, it could have been a little tighter to really hit home those connective tissues once her daughter and her do have this like coming together moment. But I mean, you know, from the get-go, like Lizzo's two opening songs made me laugh harder than a lot of movies this year. Yeah, I'm still are you okay? Like when she falls off the roof, oh my god, I was like, okay, this movie knows what it's
like
about.
The Justice League joke that's just thrown in here, which is, I mean, so funny. Things that I recognized as a teen, I used to sit there and listen to guys play their stupid guitars, and that was sort of my job to just say that sounded great.
Is that like the scene of the year? Well, isn't it just like, I mean, the idea of Gosling and this patriarchy, and the fact that, come, you know, in Barbie land, women are in control and they're believed to have solved sexism. Like it's stated at the beginning of the film through Helen Mirren's incredible narrations throughout the entire film, that, you know, like, you know, sexism and racism and all that, none of that exists in Barbie land. Like, we fixed that, you know. And and then when Ken and Barbie go to the real world in a really like hilarious and also really cool production design sort of montage, and Gosling's just incredible with his non speaking sort of, you know, just antics, like when he's in the boat and he sees the whale come out, or he's, you know, he's hanging on to the back of the rocket if they're going in the space montage. Like, it's, oh my God, just like his physical comedy is incredible. But no, then he learns that men are in control, learns about the patriarchy.
We just hide it better.
Yeah. And it's all about like fur coats, Rocky, and horses.
Yeah.
And it's so goddamn funny. I mean, I was sitting there, I'm like, yeah, we really just kind of like dilute it down to the three most like quote unquote masculine things that you can find, which is like over the top clothing and like a broken sports hero, and then like you know, like a horse riding in a commercial or something like that, and him taking the books and like, I'm gonna go back to Barbie land and teach everybody what I know, and then them coming back just like volleyball and beers, that's like the only thing. And I mean, his whole, I think that the joke, besides the guitar joke that's great, is the when they're trying to snap the Barbies out of the trance, and it's when Issa Rae goes up to Kinsley Benadire and says, I've never seen The Godfather. Yes. And can you
start again and talk all through it?
Yeah. And when he's like, this movie literally is the pinnacle of 1970s cinema. I felt every critic in there felt seen in that screening. If you've ever loved film, you felt seen. It's particularly if you're a man, you're like, holy shit, I do this all the time. And it's that kind of, it's those things in there that I know it's not a studio project. It's Greta Gerwig. It's the slap across the face at Warner Brothers for the Snyder cut of, you know, like, I'm, thank God I'd never have to watch or hear about the,
exactly,
you know,
the Snyder.
Zack Snyder's Justice League ever again. Like, it's, you know, the stuff like that. But then, of course, like
Margot Robbie is saying that she's ugly, and Helen Mirren suddenly comes in and says, Margot Robbie's definitely not the right casting for this line.
But it's like things like that where you're like, it's really sincere and everything. And you're like, and then that joke comes in there and you're just like, oh my God, that's right. Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig made this movie because there they are, you know, and I felt like watching it, they were both making white noise in this movie at the same time in the household. And you can clearly feel it. The influences on both of them, the existential dread, you know, I mean, like
American
of death.
Popular culture and what
exactly.
It's done. And I mean, all that sort of influence. But I read someone say that they felt that this film was too self-aware. And that's what I think is great about it. I mean, that there are those things that you were just saying are there and continuously coming, and I want to see it again to see what I missed, like Emerald Fennell as the pregnant Barbie.
Midge. Midge. Every time they brought, like, I swear to God, the one part that did make me laugh the most with Will Ferrell was when he comes out of the dream house and he sees Midge. He goes, ah! And he's like, I thought we discontinued you. And it was the funniest laugh of Will Ferrell stuff I had, because it was so unexpected and it kind of felt improvised, to be honest with you. And it was so good. I mean, yeah. It a movie like this, how did you not think it was going to be a self-aware comedy?
I know. Like, and knowing, why it's so good.
But knowing her sense of comedy and style, mm-hmm. like in not just, I mean, it's not really in her films a lot, but I mean, it's very much in the zone of the kind of comedies that her and Noah seem to really gravitate towards or produce or whatever. And, you know, felt clueless vibes at times too. Like that's the thing about Barbie is the more and more, you know, Oppenheimer's about all the epics that we love. Barbie is about all the, you know, about all the like Hollywood, you know, classic comedies that we love too. There's so, and musicals, and there's so many film influences on the film as you're watching it. This Barbenheimer experiment might be good for somebody that wants to get into cinema, because you're getting all kinds of tastes back and forth, because you're getting these absurdist comedies. You're getting this wonderful message film. And then you're also getting these musical sequences, like the Barbie Dreamhouse dance number. I was like, if you know and have seen Ryan Gosling do the Mickey Mouse, you know, club crap dance stuff that he did, and you loved him in La La Land, you're going to absolutely lose your mind, because it's dancing that's perfectly choreographed, but it's also extremely hilarious. And I mean, the I'm Just Ken sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, what a showstopper. If he's not on the Oscar stage
doing that, oh God,
doing that, what the hell did we do this whole thing for? Because, like, it's so hilarious.
Cancel Barbenheimer if he's not doing this.
Cancel
stage.
The Oscars.
Yes.
It has to be.
That could be
in
a
there.
Risk anyway, considering the strike. So.
True.
Careful what you wish for.
Does Hollywood really need to celebrate this year? Look what they've done. But they're definitely not going to celebrate it.
You were saying this now and how we started talking about this. There is this sort of thing that, oh, Greta Gerwig and it's such a sellout for doing this.
Oh.
Well, Noah did Madagascar too to pay for his divorce or something that I read. I mean,
it's sexist. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah. I feel very provoked by that.
Well, I saw that article. I did not read the article because the headline said enough about the, quite frankly, the bullshit that was being spewed there. I think that's horrible. One, they should retract an apology, to be fair, because of the fact that that's not an opinion at that point. That's hate speech, really. And also, you're being an unaware journalist for, like you're saying, he's done, everyone does patch jobs or does jobs to pay the bills. But it's how you do it. Like, you know, if people are so freaking precious about directors' filmographies at this point.
And why wouldn't the Gerwig be able to get a massive paycheck and IP and do Transformers, Lego Movie, Barbie, and do it this well with social commentary and everything that we want in it?
Well, also the thing is too, is she's a female director that got handed a $140 million check from the studio to make a movie. And she got to do it really when the final product on her own terms for the most part. Why the hell wouldn't you want to do that? Movies could make all of its budget domestically back this weekend. So it's clearly a hit. Doesn't matter if Mattel's bigger plans are to create a cinematic, you know, legacy or about all their toys or whatnot. That's, she's not going to be involved in any of that. And who knows if she'd be involved in a sequel to this. But like, she gets to make her own, every director gets to make their own filmography. I mean, for God's sake, we just talked about Christopher Nolan. A lot of people would consider him the premier auteur, large format filmmaker of our time. He made 3 Batman movies. There's a way you do it and a way you don't do it. And I think it might just be the studio. Warner Brothers is a studio that, even though they are in very deep water with a lot of people right now, they have always been known as the studio that lets their directors create and work, and they are a champion of the director. They always have been. That's why, like, Clint Eastwood was on their payroll for so many years. Bradley Cooper was on, you know, they gave Bradley Cooper his first chance. They've done it with Nolan before. Denis Villeneuve seems to be their new one. I mean, because Dune is a massive undertaking for any studio to greenlight. And so, yeah, to call her a sellout is below the bar. It's below the bar. And if you think that, then one, you watched a completely different film than I did. But two, also, your opinion to me isn't really valid. I mean, the same studio just did The Flash. If that's not selling out, I don't know what is. You know what I mean? Like that movie's garbage in comparison to this. And this has a vision. You see everyone talking to her, talking about her, all the cast and everything when they were doing all their interviews pre the strike. Everyone was talking about how meticulous, how smart she is, how inventive she is. You see it all on the screen. It's a $140 million film, and it feels like it's all there for a big. It's also, I want to say, I think that, and this is absolutely true, it's a big budget studio comedy. That's what this is. This isn't like this isn't an action adventure movie. When do we get to see even though it's based off a property, a comedy like this get the budget it does? And she's, Lady Bird made money. Little Women made a ton of money. And this is going to make a ton of money. Why isn't she able to craft herself to be on that pedestal? Because I know this about Christopher Nolan and directors like him. He doesn't want to be the only person like that, because how boring, you know what I mean? And she is about to enter, if she hasn't already, she definitely is on her third feature here, the same level that her it's really funny, like the directors of that 2017 lineup really all kind of now cross together as being, I think, the futures of cinema. You have Guillermo del Toro, who's, you know, working with animation and trying to save that and everything. You have Paul Thomas Anderson, who's going the indie route, but he has his own films, and he's even starting to think about working with bigger people, because I think he's going to work with like Leo and Joaquin Phoenix. You have Nolan, Jordan Peele, and then who is I think just on their level, and then Greta. Like those are I think the 5 modern filmmakers that I think that audiences can definitely trust the most. But and she's getting opportunities now that's going to open up so many doors for other female directors. That's what this is. These are 2 success stories this weekend. We should not lose that sight. Even if it is from Mattel.
What I said at the beginning, she pulled this off.
I mean,
this was a difficult thing to go into. Make a big ass studio comedy based on this existing material and do it with intelligence and subversity. And I can't believe how over my expectations she did this.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it's not my favorite of her films.
For me beats Lady Bird. So
no, I mean, that's... no, nothing. And
but
it
still.
Didn't get me. And I don't think it got me as emotional as Lady Bird or as Little Women. Little Women, there are little moments in that movie, like Chris Cooper on the stairs, that just break my heart every time I think about it. I don't want to think about it right now. But no, I think that it's definitely of her films, though, probably the one I want to rewatch the most. It's definitely the most rewatchable of her films. And I think with more rewatches, you'll be able to find all the little things, because with comedies, you know, I was talking at a film festival with the director of Bottoms that's coming out later this year, Emma Segelman, and she was talking about in comedies, you're able to just hide things more in the backdrop or in every scene. So then when the audience sees a film again, they find those Easter eggs, and then they're finding new stuff each and every time. And that's what makes a great comedy. And I think Greta's done that here. She's made a great comedy, a good social kind of satire, and you know, anti-patriarchy, pro-feminist very film. And I think that's okay for her to make that. Also too, if it's not a perfect film, that's okay. Like, not every damn movie needs to be perfect from these directors either. And that's the thing too, that's so crazy, Christina, back to your like original question. It's like, I kind of think that it's best to have these opinions come from the middle and have these non 5-star or 2-star films, like these, to have people that are in the 3.5s and the 4, and to hear why they're like that. Those are very interesting, rather than just the, because you know, some people are like straight in the bag for either one of these two films. And you know, there's going to be people that are against these films from even the time they were greenlit. So it's about having a productive conversation and dialogue. But I mean, anytime somebody does that Matchbox 20 sequence that she does, and it's not even just the guitar strumming, it's the then, I don't think, you know, you talk about faces in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
There is a shot in Barbie. It's Kingsley Benadire's face. He's sitting behind a drum set on the beach, and his Barbie leaves to go the other way. You would have felt like you shot his dog doing that. It's so funny. I was like, the level of just like facial expressions, like Ryan Gosling's facial expressions, or you know, just his aggravation at everything is incredible work. It's a movie. The more I think about it, the funnier it is. And
but I have to say, rounding things up, one of the funnest things about the Barbenheimer phenomenon during this period that we're in with strikes, when the writers and the actors are really struggling for their existence in every way, this enthusiasm for these two movies and the enthusiasm to head to the movies, to buy your tickets and to discuss these and to talk about them, it's what makes me most happy.
Yeah. I mean, it is very rare that because of streaming, because of music, because of just the culture, the way it is, that film is front and center. The anticipation is built up to this. You have hundreds of thousands of people that are seeing these movies, millions of dollars being made. I was looking at it. They're projecting 160 for Barbie. They're projecting 60 to 70 for Oppenheimer. Mission Impossible will make another 20 something million. The conspiracy theory movie will make another 20 million, because you know, the bots for them bought the tickets. And then like Indiana Jones could make 10 million. That's a lot of diversity in the marketplace. And I think it's great with these record heat waves that are going on, especially, you know, across the world, but definitely here in my neck of the woods, people are clamoring into the theaters. You're seeing every type of screenings for these movies being sold out. It does, in a moment in which our industry feels very hopeless at the idea of reaching a deal to get its lights back on, we see it thriving the most with essentially two original ideas from two of our premier filmmakers with massive casts.
As you were saying, They're both good too.
And they're both good movies.
Like, if you're a young kid who's just drawn in from the enthusiasm of doing a double feature, you're actually seeing two really good movies.
It's not like other weekends when you get two movies and you're like, well, that's a dud and the other one's fine. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like Transformers and The Flash came out in the same weekend. You know what I mean? And that's kind of the good thing, is like, it just reminds me of 15 years ago. 15 years ago, we were doing the exact same thing. Dark Knight, Mamma Mia came out. And I remember seeing, it was so crazy, the anniversary of The Dark Knight 15 years ago, I was watching Oppenheimer 15 years later on the big screen. And I saw Mamma Mia in theaters, and it was packed and people were dancing and it was fun. And that's what Barbie has been. It's been pink and dancing and fun and everyone's having a good time. I think that anyone that tries to, you know, be a cynic about the experience of going right now to the theater and seeing one over the other, I've said from the beginning, it is not about Barbie versus Oppenheimer. It is about Barbie and Oppenheimer. Both these movies need to succeed, because we need every movie like these to succeed. Because if movies like that are directed by Christopher Nolan and Greta Gerwig can't do well commercially and critically on a whole, it's then very bleak for the future of cinema. So the fact that these are now like the epicenter of culture for the next probably 2 weeks, it may be longer. It's great. I hope they make $1 billion each.
But it looks like they will, or at least be close. On that note of positivity, Ryan, it's not always we end in positivity. Thank you so much. I want to send all the listeners to awardswatch.com to read your review of Oppenheimer, which is really excellent, as well as Sophia's of Barbie. And thank you so much for being here.
Again. Oh, thank you for having me. I always love coming on. I kind of figured we were going to talk about this. I feel like we'll talk about some other big movies that are coming out, if they come out. And I know that we getting closer. I will be with you in person in the mountains of Telluride, and there will be movies. I know that there will be, but I'm so grateful to come on and yes, everybody out there, go see these movies again. You've already heard the spoilers, but you should go see them again. See them as many times as you can. Don't go see Dial of Destiny. Go see these two movies. These feel like really labors of love. And thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.